make adjustments in life no matter where you go.
So Spanish is your first language?
Yes, it is. It was, but I've lost a lot of my Spanish because I don't talk it as well. And then, you know, when you go Dominican, you go Venezuela, you go here, you go everywhere, speak to all these young men here. If I'm in Venezuela like I was for 3 years as a pitching coach and I start talking Venezuelan-type Spanish,
yeah.
And my wife kind of gets upset at me at times. And this year I'm going Dominican, so probably when I come back from Dominican, I'll probably talk in Dominican-type Spanish.
What were you doing in Venezuela?
I was a pitching coach there for 3 years in the winter ball. I went down there for winter ball, and in fact, I had a guy down there that I'm not saying I was the only reason, but he ended up pitching in the big leagues, still pitching somewhere in the big leagues, that I really felt that he was a young kid, and we worked a lot on stuff, and we corrected some stuff, and then he got Rule 5, then about a year and a half later, he was pitching in the big leagues, was Jorge Julio.
Oh.
And I feel that in winter ball, you know, really, really helped him. And a guy named Mike Gonzalez, who pitches for Atlanta right now, had him in winter ball. And then he went up next year in big leagues and had a real good year in big leagues. So those two guys, I mean, quite a few. And the good thing about going to winter ball, you have a lot of young pitchers there. A lot of young Latin kids that really want to learn, and you know, that's what I look forward to. It's just like teaching here in the States. When I go down there, I'm a pitching coach, but I'm a teacher too, and that really helps.
I was going to ask you that. You've been a coach for a long time,
mm-hmm.
in this game. Mm-hmm. You've been a manager.
Not too long.
Not too long. I mean, you managed a couple of years, right?
Yeah. Yes. Back in 1987 was the last time I managed. Yeah. Yes.
What would you rather do?
I was asked this question the other day. You know, I honestly just want to be in baseball. I honestly could do either one every day of my life. I just enjoy being out here in this, where we're at right now, at this baseball field. I enjoy watching a baseball game. Even when you're a pitching coach, you're a manager. If you really enjoy the game, you're managing the game in your mind, because situations come up. The manager's thinking what pitcher to use or what situations come up. And, you know, either one would be great. As long as I could put on a uniform and step out here, I'll be happy.
How has the game changed in 35 years? What are the big changes?
The adjustments you got to make. I think somebody said it best. It's not the kids that change. It's that we need to change with the kids in some ways. I don't think the game itself has changed that much. You still got to hit it, throw it, and pitch it. But I think that the individuals in the game have changed in a sense, because there's so much more money involved in the game. There's so many more different rules. They make so much money now, and they make it fast. And unfortunately, too, they don't play as long in the minor leagues as they used to, with all these rules where you can lose a player for so many times, da-da-da, and all this stuff. And a lot of young guys are rushed to systems and you get to the big leagues and they end up learning how to play in the big leagues. And to me, that's why it's so much different in the big leagues, is because you have a lot of young guys that haven't played enough or pitched enough.
It's this, the difference in money between 75 and now. I mean, what did you make that first year?
My first year, I made $500 a month. And my raises, I made the All-Star team in 75. My raise after that year was $50 a month. That was it. And basically, I was told by Mr. Hal Keller, sign the contract, that's all you're going to get. If you're going to make money, get to the big leagues. And nowadays, I know inflation and everything else, they make decent money. I mean, they don't make great money, but they make more than $500 a month.
Okay, here.
Here, okay. Yes, yes.
But how many guys are here that have signed bonuses?
Oh, there's a few here, but that's what I said. I mean, $1 million here, $500,000 here, $300,000. I mean, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. And unfortunately, some of them can handle it, some of them can't. Unfortunately, some of them make it, and some don't. You know, but like I said before, you still got to hit it, throw it, and catch it. And to me, that's what you're going to be judged on.
And this is the juncture. Is that true? Do you agree with that? They say AA is make or break.
You know what? I think it's changed quite a bit. I think when I was in AA, we didn't have too many older guys in AA as we do now. I think there's a lot of guys in AA playing that are older guys. I believe when I was in AA in 76, most of the guys were my age or younger, which I was 24, 23 years old, 24. We didn't have guys that were 29 and 30 on those teams. We were all almost in the same age group, you know, and we didn't have guys like that around. Nowadays, you know, you have guys that are 27, 28 playing in this level. You know, you got guys that's a closer and buoys that's 32, 33 or whatever. And in some ways it's a disadvantage because they do know more than you do as far as playing-wise and pitching-wise and hitting-wise and everything else. And we've been known in Minnesota, and it's basically true. If you look, check everything else, we're the youngest. Everywhere we go, we're the youngest. So you're always teaching players how to play, while other teams have players that played a while. And in time, the good ones get better, you know, but it's a learning experience playing against older guys.
You played in, you coached for the Pirates, Expos, Seattle, in Texas,
yes,
and Minnesota.
Well, Minnesota in the minor leagues, yeah, but all those other teams in the big leagues, yes, sir.
Okay. Yes. Was there a difference? Is there a difference in these systems?
Everything. There's all difference. There's difference in every system, but as far as I'm concerned, this organization here is the best organization I've ever been in. I can say that clearly because whatever you do in A-ball, you do in the big leagues. Whatever you do in rookie ball, you do in the big leagues. The system is taught the same way all the way through. So when people go from one level and next level to the next level, all the things we do are the same, and the approaches are pretty much the same. Of course, people are different, but the approach itself is the same way. And when I came here in 2002, it was the only people that would hire me in 2002. But when I came here, you know, I learned and I watched, and you know, the 3-4 years I was here from 2002 to 2005, you know, I got a chance to go to the big leagues a couple of times and sit up there with Guardy and his staff, and it really helped me because when I teach here, you know, I do emphasize on these players the things I learned from Guardy and their staff and what they want there, you know, because the difference is a little bit bigger and different in the big leagues than it is.
Who's that? Guardy?
Yes, Gardenhire.
Oh, Gardenhire.
Big league manager.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. You know, you bring up an interesting point. You guys that have been around for a long time, how hard is it to get jobs sometimes?
Very hard. In fact, when I got let go by Texas, I really could not find a job anywhere. I always thought because I had all those years in the big leagues and nobody really thought that you wanted a job in the minor leagues or, you know, but I grew up in the minor leagues. I spent 11 years or 12 years in the minor leagues with Seattle. So, you know, when Minnesota offered me the job, I still remember, you know, Rick Knapp, the coordinator, said, well, we can't pay you what you were making in the big leagues. I said, Nappy, I grew up in the minor leagues. You give me a salary and I'll go do the job for you. And like I said, I was fortunate enough to go to Triple with a lot of good arms and a lot of good players, and we won a championship. And, you know, that just kind of set everything off here with Minnesota.
But have you had problems before that?
Well, like I said, not really, because when I got let go from Seattle, you know, I went to Montreal, but Jim Beattie was there that knew me. And then, you know, Texas was a situation where people knew me there too. But, if people don't know you or feel that you really don't want to do this anymore, sometimes it's difficult. I don't know whether it'd be as difficult now, because I've been back in the minor leagues for a while, and that, you know, I've talked to a lot of people and met a lot of people and stuff like that. But, you know, sometimes I believe people don't think that you really want to do this anymore because of the time you had in the big leagues. But some people call me a lifer. I don't know what that means sometimes, but like I told you before, baseball is baseball. Whether you played here or played in the big leagues, you still play.
Are there other guys like you, Bobby?
There's quite a few. There's quite a few people. I don't know if they have the same story I do, but there's quite a few people that have been in this game a long, long time and enjoy being out here. I mean, you know, to name them, I couldn't name because I think there's so many of them that just enjoy being at the baseball park, having a job. And, you know, this is the greatest job in the world, being on a baseball field.
There are some legendary minor league coaches.
Oh, there is.
Johnny Lippon and guys like that.
I knew Johnny Lippon. I knew John Lippon real well. You know, he's managing the Pirate system. When I played against him, I remember him really well.
He had tiny feet. God, yeah. He had small feet.
Yeah, there's quite a few of them. I can't remember the guy that was in Triple-A for the Giants right offhand, but, I mean, he was...
Gilbert?
Sir?
Gilbert?
No, sir. I can't remember his name, but he was there a long time, too. But, you know, you get to meet these people. That's the biggest difference, too, now. You know, back when I was in the minor leagues, I used to go with, you know, you could talk to them. You know, umpires. You know, you could sit with umpires, talk to umpires, you know, not really yell at them, but, you know, have communication. That's a difference, too. The umpires are different now. They're younger. I don't know why, but it's a lot harder now with umpires than it was before.
You mean in the game? Or
in the game itself,
yeah,
yes.
They don't want to...
Well, it's different. It's difficult, I think. I don't blame them as much as anything else, but it's just a different breed. I mean, they have their rules, and they have their unions, and they have their deals. And, you know, back then it was, you know, guys would go up to the big leagues, umpires, and, you know, quite a few umpires, Eric Gregg and all those guys I came up with, and Joe West and all these people that were in the minor leagues when I was in the minor leagues, you know, they were, you know, they're different than they are now, in my opinion.
Joe West is still there.
No, I know Joe West is still there. I know that.
Got in the way of a pitcher catching last night.
I know him real well. Joe West was an umpire in 75 in the Carolina League when I was there.
Really?
Yes, in 75.
Was he picking people up and throwing them around then?
Well, he was pretty much Joe West. You know, Joe hasn't changed very much because, in fact, in 77 when I played in Puerto Rico, he was down in Puerto Rico, and not to say stories, but I think he was escorted off the field quite a few times by police there, too.
Really?
Oh, well, Joe never backed down from anything. So, you know, he's about the same way he is now.
Well, he's a little better, isn't he, than he was?
Well, I'm talking about, you know, he's right. When Joe's right, he's right. And when Joe calls something, it's called. And that's all there is to it.
Was that the only time you had trouble getting another job?
Well, that was the only time, yes.
Okay.
Definitely the only time. The only time. But again, you know, you make your choices, and the choices will make you. That's what I always say. So my choice was, you know, even when I left to go to Pittsburgh last 2 years, you know, bullpen coach for Jim Tracy, that was difficult for me, leaving here, because it was like family here.
Yeah.
You know, it was a tough choice for me. And fortunately for me, when we got let go of Pittsburgh last year, when I called here, you know, I was looking for a job, and, you know, and they found me a job. So, you know, I'm very appreciative of Minnesota. Like I said before, I'll do anything for them. I'll do whatever they want me to do, and, you know, I'm very grateful to them.
Yeah, but there are a lot of these guys. There are guys that have been around.
Many.
Isn't Andy Etchebarren managing somewhere?
I really don't know. But, you know, there's a lot of guys that have been around. Everywhere, you know. I mean, Mo Hill's with Bowie, I believe. Mo Hill and I together were in Seattle in 87. He was a hitting coordinator in 87. So that's 20-something years ago that we were together.
So you run into these a lot.
You run into
guys that you've been with.
Yes,
in the...
A lot. Like I said, John Stearns and I played together in the Basin League in 1971.
Yeah.
So how many years ago was that? That's quite a few. About 36 years ago.
36 years ago.
Yeah, so you run into people.
How long does this go on?
Forever.
As long as... Do you see yourself as 95 here?
As long as somebody gives me a job, as long as God gives me the ability to do what I got to do, or what I can do and help, I'll do this as long as they let me.
Yeah. And on this level, on lower level?
Any level. Because you're still doing the one thing that my theory about this game is, those people out there, those players up there, they're your sons. Okay. Everybody that goes out there is your son. So you treat them like they're your sons. As I told somebody before, when you go out there and there's a situation come up where somebody could get hurt or you're going to go a little farther than you should, think of it first. If it was your son, would you do it or not? And to me, that's the way I approach what I do. When I try to teach, in the sense that I'm trying to teach young men to be better at what they do, but I'm trying to teach them to be better individuals as we go along too. Because after baseball, you still have a life. Okay? And if I can teach them to be better people, they'll be better ball players for you too. That's the way I feel.
How about some of the guys you coached with?
Coached with?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I mean, like the guy now, right?
Floyd?
Floyd.
Well, Floyd and I, you know, Floyd, I met Floyd here when I was...
Floyd Rayfield.
You know, Floyd's Floyd. You know, Floyd's been around a long time too, coaching. You know, been different situations, different places. He's a baseball man. I mean, Well, he tells stories, and I listen to stories about Baltimore. He played a long time in the big leagues. I didn't, you know. He tells me stories about Weaver and everything he went through and all the times he got sent down in 1 year, eight times or whatever he got sent down or whatever. You know, and you just listen to stories, and you try to, really and truly, you try to pass on stories to the players so they keep it going too, some way, somehow. So, you know, you adjust to everything you do. If you don't adjust and get out of the game, it doesn't matter where you're at. Because it, whether you be in New Britain or whether you're in the big leagues, you're going to have to make adjustments of what you're doing.
What did you throw as a pitcher? What
was only threw two pitches for most of my career. I threw a fastball and a curveball. And my curveball was probably my best pitch. I know it was my best pitch because I had a real good curveball. So with a curveball and a fastball, I got the big leagues, basically. I tried to learn a palm ball probably my last year. I was pitching the last couple of years, and I used it a little bit, but my bread and butter pitch was a curveball, which I could throw anytime, any place, anyhow.
And it got you to the majors.
And it got me the big ones.
Would it have been different, Bobby, if you had not got to the majors, even four games?
I don't know. I can't answer that. I can't answer that. Because like I told you before, I didn't think about playing in the big leagues. I just wanted to play. And even when I started coaching, I'll put it this way. When I started coaching, I never thought about being a big league pitching coach. I just wanted to be in this game and learn and teach. And I never, in fact, I'll put it this way. My wife got a little upset with me because in 85, I was a Triple-A pitching coach. And out of that group, I can't remember all the pitching coaches were there, but out of that group in 85, within a year, four of them were big league pitching coaches in that level. And I go back to managing A-ball. And my wife, my friends and my wife told me all the same thing. What are you doing? I said, well, you know, I said, and I'm not being facetious. If God wants me to be a big league pitching coach, I'll be back. And in 1995, I went back, and I became a big league pitching coach.
You seem to me like the guy that doesn't question a lot. Whatever is there, you jump on the opportunity.
Well, let me put it this way. I question things. Now,
a lot more people are asking a lot more questions, aren't they?
Well, like I said before, I think the question is, how can I get somebody ready to be big leagues for Minnesota Twins? How can I watch a guy play out there, or watch a guy throw in the game, or watch a bullpen, or watch a hitting session, or watch a ground ball session? How can I go through the proper channels or the proper way of trying to tell somebody, hey, listen, this is the way you ought to do it because this, pardon me, this is the way you're going to get the big leagues. Because you can watch a guy pitch out here and get people out. And you know he ain't going to pitch in big leagues that way. So when do you go there and tell this young man, even though he's being successful, son, we need to change this. Because what I've seen in the big leagues and the way you're doing it, it's not going to work for you. Understand? And this is even hitting or fielding or whatever, or running the bases or in the outfield play. You know, because there's some talented kids that get by. But unfortunately, they get by and all of a sudden they get to a certain level and haven't made an adjustment and they hit a wall. My best view is, okay, how can I help this kid here now do things now so when he goes to AAA, he doesn't have to make an adjustment. And to me, that's a big thing in baseball for me is, here is that I see it and I go, okay, this is how I can make this better. That way when he gets to the next level, he doesn't have to make that adjustment that people make. He already knows how, and he'll just handle that better than somebody else that just let play or let him go, and then all of a sudden he's got to make the adjustment to AAA all over.
You went up to the major leagues, A, double A, triple A, major leagues, right?
Yes, sir.
I mean, you made every step every year.
Yes, sir.
Right? I mean, that's kind of a good deal, isn't it?
Well, it was just, I don't know, you're at the right place at the right time. I believe, and you work at it. You work at it pretty hard. And you work as hard as anybody or harder than anybody. And when they say pitch, you pitch. Back then, when they say pitch, you pitch. And that's the way, you know, I was lucky enough to get there. With two pitches, fastball and curveball.
More and more involved in owning and running a car myself, so, you know, and one of the reasons I was sponsoring the 32 car because Noki was driving, and he lost his ride there this year because that team, you know, had its problems this year, and they decided to go a different route, you know. But I'll be a minor sponsor to their car, and I'm not doing anything for ISMA, you know.
Okay. How long you've been involved with racing? A long time, Mike?
Well, I go back to in the late 70s and early 80s. And believe it or not, when Mike was a kid, I even though he looks old, I used to manage Mike's father's business, Mike's Truck Stop.
Okay, where were you when I needed rescue one night there?
Yeah, I know it. But I managed the truck stop back in the late 70s, and Noki Fanoa drove then, and Mike was racing then. They were national champs. I kind of got a taste of the racing end there because I saw it involved with the business and the old man and everything else. And then eventually in the 80s when I and Mike passed away, Mike and I had our little differences, and we parted company. And ever since then, I've been on my own, self-employed. Now I was a junkyard owner for 25 years. I've been self-employed most of my life, you know.
Okay.
And I was a very successful, scrap junkyard dog, if you want to call me. And I semi-retired in 97 and come out of retirement a little bit. And after that, in 2000, and I formed Helping Hands. And in the last 7 years, I've raised $8 million for local charities, you know.
Now, how does that work?
People donate cars, trucks, and boats. I don't take cash. I just take tangible items, and it's, resellable.
Yeah.
And my primary three items are cars, trucks, and boats. I bought the former Morocco Auto Salvage Yard on Route 1 in Rentham, right next door to the old... You never burn bridges, right? And I ended up 30 years later, I ended up at the same place I started, right next door to Mike's Truck Stop. I bought the Morocco Auto Salvage operation, and I have a five-acre complex over there. People donate cars. They get a tax deduction. I resell whatever they donate, and I raise money for the charity.
Okay. But this is a profit company.
I'm a for-profit corporation.
Technically,
you can call me. I'm a public solicitor.
Okay, so this is my own, for my own edification here. Does your charter, so to speak, say you have to raise so much a year for charity? Is that the way that exists?
No. Whatever charities I assist, I have a contractual obligation with them. There's an agreed percentages to start off with each individual charity, and they get a percentage of the funds that I raise.
Okay.
They have no liabilities. They have no investment. I do all the advertising. I do everything. I take care of all the tax stuff. I handle the donation. I pick it up, and I have a five-acre complex. I have all the local and state licenses. I'm also a boat dealer, car dealer, and I'm able to resell whatever tangible items I take in, you know?
Okay. Okay, you resell it, and the charity and specific charities.
The charities get a part. I help four local charities at the present time. If you hear Pete Falcone do his PR thing at every race, but he has a PR release and basically describes about. But anyways, I give a percentage of all the monies I raise to four local charities, which is ALS, which is Kurt Schilling, the Blind Association, Meals on Wheels for the Elderly,
yeah,
and Sacred Heart Missions out of Fairhaven, Massachusetts.
Okay, what's
They're
the first...
basically missionaries that deal with third world countries, you know?
What's the first one, ALS?
ALS, that's Lou Gehrig's
disease. And that's Schilling is...
With Kurt Schilling, that's our special, yeah, we're associated with him.
Okay, and the second one?
Is... Association of Blind Citizens.
Okay.
I help the blind people.
Alrighty.
And Meals on Wheels for the Elderly and Sacred Heart Missions.
When did you get back involved? When did you get involved as a midget owner?
I got back in the midget situation in roughly almost 5 years ago.
Okay.
Mike approached me about helping sponsor getting Nokia ride. He got into the number two car of Don Berrio.
Yeah.
So I co-sponsored that car, and 6 months later, I got involved in sponsorship of NEMA and ISMA, and it just took off from there, you know?
Okay.
Eventually, I sponsored the number 12 car of Kyle Carpenter, and because Kyle and Brad were going to be the crew chiefs of the 12 of the two car that Nokia was driving. And I won't go into fine details. You don't have to print it, but Hassel Berrio kind of shoved it up my ass after I had paid everything up front and everything else. He released Nokia as a driver, and so out of spite, I built the number four car and whipped his ass.
Is this what kind of this number four was like a new midget when you got it?
That's brand. Yeah, I built a brand new and during the 2005 season, but we didn't really race it. We raced a couple of races and at the end of the 2005 season, and Nokia won the World Series in 2005 at Thompson with it. And then last year was its first maiden year, and we ended up 16 points out of the championship last year with a brand new car. If I went to DNF, all I needed was the start in the World Series, and I won the championship. We would have beat Ben Seitz, you know. But I DNF'd the freaking fuel pump. The shaft on the fuel pump, Pete, shared, and the car wouldn't fire for the feature. Isn't that something?
You missed it.
I missed the championship by 16 points.
You missed it, not Noki?
Yeah, I missed it because he was driving a Super. He came in like fourth or fifth place.
Okay, so you missed the point championship by
16 points in 2006, yep.
Okay, wow.
A brand new car.
So, but the relationship with you and Noki goes back to
30 years, yeah?
Yeah, it goes back to when he was driving for Mike.
Mike and that, yeah.
Do you have a particular love for midgets?
Originally getting started with Mike and everything else, and all the different friends and people I've met along the years, you know, Humphrey and Lodine and all those guys. You know, I just, Mike had some good people driving for him over the years, and all the good friendships and people I met, you know, and it just came back. It's just kind of a local thing, you know, between Seacock, Norwood, Westboro, you know, we're all our local tracks, you know, and, you know.
Now, Mike, Mike, Iron Mike,
yeah,
is going to go into the Hall of Fame.
Idea, huh?
You must be very excited about that.
Yes, Mike just told me. It was, hang on a second, I'm going to plug in the cell phone before it runs out. Yeah, because how close you were with him. The people thought he was a real tough bastard, but the guy was, had a heart of gold and was a nice old guy, you know. You just had to know him behind the edges, you know.
I did not know him very well, but I remember there being at the truck stop one night with Slater.
Yeah.
With Bill Slater, and for some reason, I mean, he was going after Slater. Slater knew what the hell he was doing, but I didn't know, and I remember being afraid.
Yeah.
And then,
I and Mike, every other word out of his mouth is, you fucking asshole.
Yeah, but I mean, I thought he was really, really mad at Slater and was going to do him harm. Slater knew what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Slater knew him.
Natural actions, you know, yeah.
Slater knew him as well as anybody, I think, so.
Yeah.
You know, I remember that. Then I went there one night with Bones, I was with Bonesy one day, and we stopped there.
Yeah.
And he went after the both of us being lame, yeah, being stupid bastard writers, I remember.
I've got, it's a shame that people have taken advantage of me because of my wealth and everything else. But I don't know if you take, like, our buddy Val LeSueur, the last year that Val was involved with Race the Rammer at Gillette Stadium, which wasn't a bad show, is that a week before the show, Gillette Stadium needed monies to put the show on, and, you know, NEMA and all the participants are already paid their $300 to $600 fees and entry fees and everything else, and a week before the show was going to be canceled because Val hadn't come up with the financial backing that he needed, and I put up $40,000 to promote and put that show on, and Val ran away with all the funds, you know. So so I'm up $40,000 and about $12,000 in court fees and lawyer's fees for our buddy Val LeSueur, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. You might be in a bad spot here, Michael. I don't know how you're going to get blood out of that rock.
Oh, I already, it's done. I personally bankrupt him. Now his kids, it's just a shame. I really put him against a wall legally and everything else, that now that his himself personally and his family and everything else, everything is so attached that, you know, who knows what's going to happen. Yeah. So myself and, I mean, you know, my $50,000 is no big thing. There's other people that, you know, in the paper business, and he had signed an agreement with a newspaper down in North Carolina and all kinds of stuff. I mean, he hadn't been paying people for a year, and, you know, there's people that do $100,000 and $200,000. You know, he was really stiffing things. I mean, even that spring before the Race of Rammer, you know, he had advertised subscriptions, you know, 3 years for $90. He knew what he was doing. Everybody paid subscriptions up front for 3 years, and, you know, 3 months later, he's defunct. You know, so, I mean, all the race fans and all the midgets, everybody really got raped by him, you know.
Is Mike Scrivani your official crew chief? Or?
No, he's not, no, I don't know why that got printed. He basically, you know, he likes Doki. He's a consultant. He works on basically everybody's car. He does a lot of work on Eddie Bro's car. I basically crew my own car. He's just a little bit of an advisor. He advises a lot of people. I mean, even at the Seekonk race, that little DiMartino girl that wrecked Pretty Gab by it, he was working on her Volkswagen car. And as much as people want to say, you know, poor Mike, he works on everybody. He'll give anybody advice. For a guy that's never driven a car in all his life, just sitting in the infield, he can tell you exactly what's good or bad about your car, what your driver is doing. Honest, he's got that instinct, Pete, that he can diagnose a car, and he can come back in the pits, and he can tell you, he can rip that car apart and tell you exactly what the car was doing, what's wrong, you know, and everything else. And
did his father have that?
His father a little bit, you know, but Mike, from a kid, all the success that Mike's had, you know, the old man Mike had is from Mike himself. He was basically his crew chief, his engineer. Mike designed a lot of stuff that he did with the Badgers, and you know, a lot of things that got outlawed is because Mike was always pushing things to the limits and had all kinds of ideas. He's a machinist by trade, and, you know, part engineer, and he's done well, you know. And he really knows, you know, he built his own race cars, and that would a little help in the old days with, you know, remember old Roy Lindblad, you know, Lindblad chassis and Mike. But Mike designed all this stuff, built all his own motors, and he did well, you know.
Which Mike?
Young Mike. The dad was a little advisor and the financial man and loved the racing, and young Mike did all the work, you know.
The situation with NEMA now.
Yeah.
Not the political situation.
Yeah.
The situation of all these rookies.
Yeah.
You know, you got guys like Noki, and now at least it sounded like Drew was coming back next year.
There's a chance. It all depends what this guy wants to do with him. He, you know, he's got a young son that's in college and loves the racing, but he's going to Rensselaer Polytech Institute.
Yeah, extremely bright, I hear.
Yeah, the school load has been too much for him, and he had to forgive the racing for the, who knows, you know.
But the whole situation, with NEMA now.
Yeah.
With the rookies, with, I thought Erica Santos has just lent amazing credibility to the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, people watching her, I think, you know, like Mike said to me, people come to the race and they go home. They might not know who won, but they know where Erica finished.
Sure. Yeah. It's been a good thing for the club, but you got to look too. Is that overall there's a lot of good equipment. There's 10 to 15 guys that can win every night. It's not a Gene show anymore, you know, or maybe a Ben Sight show. If you look right now, and even like last year, where we go? We won 8 races before you got a repeat winner.
Yeah.
You know? So there's a lot of good. It's very competitive. The rookies after a couple of races really came out shining. Right now, NEMA is working on taking over the regional, northeast region of Ford Focus.
Yeah.
And they're going to basically, might call it the NEMA Sportsman Division. And so we don't lose guys when they come out of quarter midget to try to do something else. We're going to try to change some rules in NEMA and where we can bring in kids at 14, 15 years old in that sportsman division. Because right now you're going to be 16th and driving a NEMA midget, you know.
God, I hope they don't lower that.
Well, we're not going to lower that, but they're going to be NEMA members, but they're going to be able to drive
in the
Ford Focus division.
Yeah.
You know, but the rules are going to change. It's not going to be a Ford Focus car. Mm. Some of the guys that still have Ford Focus cars left can come into it, but we're going to try to put them into, you know, midget cars with, like, Ford 4s and things like that. You know, a more streamlined. See, right now, the Ford Focuses are kind of boring only because of the fact is that they're all set up identical, and then they put a small hard compound tire that they can't pass, they can't do nothing, you know. So it's not attractive to the crowds. And then the thing that the Ford Focus try to do, you know, with the fancy Penske shock, they put out a 35,000 to Ford Focus car that if you don't run it in Ford Focus, you can't do nothing with anymore, you know.
Mm.
So we're looking for these kids to get into, you know, a used Hawk chassis or a used Beast chassis, put a Quad 4 into it and try things, and hopefully we're going to try to put a wing on them, and then eventually, after a couple of years of driving that, all they got to do is increase their horsepower and already have it, and do it in that same car and chassis, you know. They won't have to go, you know, throw that $35,000 Ford Focus they got away and then start all over again.
What kind of chassis do you have?
I have a Beast chassis with a Gurdy Ford.
Okay. Okay. And you expect that little Paisan to be back next year?
I look at what?
You expect that Noki will be back driving next year?
Yeah, right now his only ride right now. He really loves the Supers. If something breaks, that's up to him. You know, to me, I'm not in this for the champ. I'm in for the fun of it and everything else and to help everybody out. And, you know, if he drives part-time for me, that's fine, you know. But right now, I'm his only race, you know, his only car. So, you know, I feel a little, I don't know what you want to call it, but it would be nice if I had him full-time, you know.
Okay.
And we could get a full season in, you know.
Well, now, you left Scrivani. My Iron Mike passed away.
Yeah.
And you left that operation.
Yeah.
Went into the scrap business.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I retired.
And you retired from that, and then you came back with this Helping Hands.
Yes. I semi-retired in 97, and then 2000. The year 2000, I came back with Helping Hands, and I ended up next door at the old truck stop and met the old friends again and got back into racing. You know?
Okay. I thank you very much, sir.
Okay. And whatever NEMA needs, we'll be there. You know, we don't worry about the politics that's happened. I, you know, I've never burnt any bridges between you and I. If Valari feels that 4 fucking championships in a row are better for him than the health and welfare of NEMA and our personal friendship and everything else. You know, we were He helped me build that original number four. Ben and I were stable mates for a year. My summer home is about 10 minutes from Valari's house, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a practical thing and everything else, you know. But you know, I was successful before NEMA. You know, and I'll be successful after.
Yeah. Well,
and we will survive, you know.
It
and everything else, you know. But whatever NEMA needs, I'll be there. Mike and I met with CECON Tuesday night. We already got four races going. You know, Waterford wants us for hopefully four. Thompson for maybe two or three. Lee wants us for two. Monadnock wants us for two. We've already got a full slate, but only a half a dozen tracks. Oswego's trying to cart us for a couple of races, but they just never wanted to pay, you know. Wall wants to do something. Riverhead wants to do something. You know, Airport up in Plattsburgh been after us. You know, there's a lot of things happening. We're probably not going to go back to Star because he don't pay his bills, you know. And when he does, he discounts the purse because he pays what you feel, what the show was, you know. So he's going to have financial problems, you know. I hear through the
so NEMA's in good shape.
Oh, we're in terrific shape, especially with us getting involved with Ford Focus to bring in, hopefully on a regular basis, bring more rookies in and everything
okay.
else.
Well, I want to hold up on that until
NEMA is in
until Mike tells me.
Well, you know, promoters and everybody else, it hasn't been. We don't really have to go searching for. Already, look at this. There it is in October, and promoters are already coming us to book us. We were the first division talked to by CECON. Already, people are after us, you know, we won't be scrambling like in March or April trying to fill a 16 race.
I would imagine. Mike talked to me yesterday. I talked to Mike yesterday.
Yeah.
And I told him to call Bill Roth. Bill Roth's schedule has NEMA on it for four races.
Okay. Yeah.
For the same dates, the same exact dates
of last year.
Of last year.
Okay.
You
all
know.
Right.
So I mean, well, you're not going to have any troubles. What?
Well, we booked for CECON. There should be no conflicts. Okay.
No, there should be no conflicts. But I mean, you're not going to have trouble getting four dates at Waterford.
Okay, that's good.
So you know. I mean, they're already there, and that.
Goddamn wall. I can't remember. This is how it starts. This guy spins. He hits him. Halaquist here. Bill Brown's heading for the wall. Yeah, and he goes.
Wow.
That's a fisher there, boy. And then we ran there twice in a week, and then he won the next one there.
So why did you get out of the sprinters? What was the reason for getting out of the sprinters?
Oh, Matt Sack, our mutual buddy.
Slater was afraid that's where you were coming today. I don't think Jimmy Jorgensen's going to Matt Sack's.
I said, you're looking out for the end of the driveway. Because him and I don't see eye to eye.
Yeah, no, me neither. Well, he screwed me up. He tried. I don't know if I got the better of him finally or he got the better of me. We took the car, the sprint car, to the auto show in Hartford, right? Trailer and that. So he happened to tow it over. He's got the trailer and all that. Next thing, he's not bringing the car back. So we can, you know, work on it and get rid of it. Well, I decided I wanted to keep it over to my house. Now, this car is the one I straightened out, was wrecked, and did a lot of fucking work on it. So anyhow, he decided he's keeping that in the trailer. Well, what am I going to do? So he's got the car. So he just waited and waited and waited. And eventually he wants to go run the car. But I got all the tires and wheels, all the mag wheels. On the sprint car, all the gears. John McCarthy comes over with him. And John says, "Oh, give him the stuff, you know, because John and him were always like that anyway, right?" "No, I'm giving him nothing, John." I says, "You give me $3,000, and I says, I'll give you the tires and working wheels, and we'll kiss the deal goodbye." Well, finally, John wrote the check. for it. And that was it. That was the end of the sprint car business.
You never had any role in that Crown 7 car that Gene drove. No. You were never part of that.
No. No. He picked, I don't know where he bought that Skipper. Bought that from some guy.
Well, that was what's his name? Warren, whatever his name is. Centinelli or whatever it is. He was the
Yeah, I know he, who you're talking about.
He was the guy that was behind that, that Crown 7.
Yeah. That had that little Dodge.
Yeah. So you don't know why you left sprint cars? I mean,
well, I didn't have a car after that. Okay. I was gone.
Okay.
So, you know, working any deal with good. That's when I got talking with Buzz.
Okay. How did you know this Indy car was available?
Because I worked with him the year before.
Worked
at the Speedway.
Worked with Brent.
With Brent.
You had gone out, so in 67 you had gone out there.
68.
No, 68, you're running. 68.
That's where there's confusion.
Now.
Right? Because I got a pin that's from the Speedway for 68.
And you
and
went
Brent
to,
got that for me because we went down to the office.
You went in 68 with Brent.
Yeah.
But you had your own car. That's why you ran your own car, but you went to Indy with Brent in 68.
Brent.
68.
I know that was 68 with Brent.
Yeah.
I know we were there in 69.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. But I think you were out there, you were part of Brent's team because you didn't, this, your team didn't go to Indy in 68.
No. Oh, no.
No. And I think that was.
One year.
Did you know Brent before that? Did you know Brent?
Racing with him in URC.
Okay.
Yeah, because he had sprinters.
Okay. So you somewhere you must have been aware that this car existed.
Yeah, well, I don't know who it was. Bill had mentioned. See, Bill was a heavy equipment mechanic for them.
Who?
Bill Brown.
Oh, okay.
So, of course, then, you know, round and around.
Okay. Yeah. When you brought that car home, you brought that first car home, what did you bring it home in? Okay.
All right. That's why I was wondering if he got the friggin' trailer from him. Tied the stuff on there.
But it was...
It wasn't a rolling chassis. There was no suspension. All of it was there.
Okay, it was literally all in pieces.
Yeah.
Now, you say, then the next year you got two cars. You know you got two cars.
Yeah.
Right? And you went to Indy with a brand new Gearhart chassis.
Yeah.
And how did that come about that you got that new Gearhart chassis?
We just talked it over, Buzz and I, and he thought it would be a good idea, too. And we had a decent motor. You know, let's get a new one. Because Gurney's head mechanic, too, Bill Fowler, he was the chief on Gurney's stuff, and he was a smart guy. One night he was over and that, and he says, you know, he says, this car is never going to be perfect for you by any means, for the fact that Gearhart, where they put the suspension points, are not quite where they should be. In other words, when the suspension moves, it's going to change toe steer, bump steer, and things like that. So we thought, well, maybe we get a newer one. Things would be better. It wouldn't be so critical to ride height with the suspension. And it was a little better than the older one, but it still wasn't.
You bought the second Gearhart, or somebody gave you the Gearhart chassis. You picked it up at Indy, right?
The wrecked one.
The wrecked one.
Yeah.
And you bought it for the motor.